question is, do they get the flavor right? Do they get the images right? Do they get some of the textures right? Which I think they do really well.
Today on All About Jack, C.S. Lewis podcast, we're focusing on the motion picture entitled Tolkien. That is new for 2019. I'm William L. Flaherty, your host. I'm the creator of EssentialCSLewis.com and the author of two books, one an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters entitled C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, and another book called The Misquotable C.S. Lewis. Joining me on the show today are two guests to discuss the Tolkien biopic, Britton Dickinson and Dr. Diana Glier. Before we get to it, for those who are unaware, Lewis and Tolkien were close friends for many years, and that's why I wanted to discuss this movie. In fact, one of Lewis's most famous books, The Screwtape Letters, was dedicated to Tolkien. Let's join the recorded interview where I introduce our guest. Here with me via Skype are a couple of friends to welcome back to All About Jack. Let me introduce both of them here. Diana Glier is a professor of English and scholar of both C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. Her most recent book is entitled Bandersnatch. Thanks for joining us, Diana.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
And then Britton Dickinson is a teacher and writer in Prince Edward Island. He is near the completion of a Ph.D. on C.S. Lewis at the time of this recording, which is the 1st of June 2019. He writes about the Inklings at apilgriminnarnia.com. Thanks for being here today, Britton.
Yeah, awesome to join you.
All right, so this is the biopic Tolkien. It just focuses in on his young life, so we want to make sure people are aware of that if they haven't seen it. Of course, at the time of people listening, it may be still an opportunity, which we'll talk about how it wasn't in too many theaters, and as well as maybe you're catching it in the podcast here now later, and it's out on DVD. We don't know what's exactly going to be on the DVD, but we have some information, at least I'm aware of some, and we'll see what my guests know. But let's begin with this. Instead of a yes, no about whether you'd recommend the movie, let's start with a number scale of 1 to 10, without giving any reasons why, 1 being no way, let's protest the movie, to 10 representing stop everything and go see it now, or if it's on DVD when you hear this, then go rent it or buy it. So what do you think, Diana?
I'm going to ask Brenton to answer that first, because my answer is going to be a little more complicated. So what do you say there, Brenton?
Yeah, are we going to like take over the podcast already, Diana?
We're totally going to subvert this. Go.
Yeah, I mean, like, for sure, kind of like, if you're just like biopics and sort of that historical or biographical kind of scene setting thing, then this is a pretty good 7 or 8. And we'll talk a little bit later about how Tolkien fans kind of watch this. But yeah, I would put it in 7 or 8. Reminding, of course, it's a pretty low budget film. So Against the King's Speech or Imitation Game, it looks a little thinner. But I was very moved by it. I loved watching it.
Good. So I'm with you. What I would just I think the first part of what you said may be the most important, Brenton, and that it really depends on the kind of film that you like. So if you're looking for a lot of action adventure, if you're looking for a lot of dazzle, if that's the reason that you go to the movie theater, you are not going to like this. But if you're the kind of person that likes a thoughtful, character-driven story that enjoys a period piece and appreciates great costuming, subtle acting, kind of get interesting slice of life kind of a film, I give it an 8 or a 9.
Yeah. What a great film for face acting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, the close-ups, the facial shots. Yeah. No, it was really strong. And, of course, the set design was quite well done. The ones in England, anyway, yeah.
Yeah, set costumes. Mm-hmm. I think the casting was really, really good. And you mentioned this in some of your writing on the film, but I was also so taken by the music. It's one of the best scores I've seen in a long time, both in terms of the range of music that's selected and the way that the music fits the scene. The music is a constant through it, and I think the score is absolutely brilliant. I think it's really amazing.
Yeah, the score kind of keeps tugging. It just tugs you a little further, each one. And so it kind of weaves together the scenes because you can tell that this was a much longer film that was cut. But yes, the score seems to make up a lot of that Scotch tape in it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me jump in here, and although you've mentioned some answer to what my next question was planned, and that is, if you had to boil it down to one or two aspects or parts that you felt the movie covered very well, what would you say? And it doesn't matter to me who goes first. Who wants to go first?
Well, yeah, I guess there's a few things, actually. So I think we could talk about Tolkien and history in a little bit, maybe, because I think that's what listeners are going to be wondering about that kind of, fidelity to the historical moment. Like, as a biopic, as a kind of a period piece that is a biographical story. So I loved any of the big pan shots of the cities or forests. Any of those scenes, the villages and things like the country scenes were lovely. The scene in the restaurant where they're talking about cellar door. Yeah, it was really kind of one of the more sensual and intimate. There's like a kissing scene later, but this one is really much more erotic and connected, and not just in the touch or something, and they're talking about linguistics. And it was just kind of a very sexy scene, a very beautiful scene. And and then I thought Tolkien's mom, Mabel Tolkien, played by Laura Donnelly. I thought the two or three short shots we have are her and I. So those are just three of the things that I thought. Each of those very, or two of those very character driven.
Yeah, I was really struck throughout. I think the people who made this movie really cared about this story, and that meant a lot to me. They were trying really hard to tell the story well. And I think you see that in a lot of the details. You see that in a lot of the scenes and images. I thought they did a good job of capturing something of Tolkien's personality. So some of the critics have contrasted this with the movie Shadowlands, which attempts to tell something of C.S. Lewis's life. And there they tell a good story, but they really botch any sense that C.S. Lewis was actually like this guy that's portrayed by Anthony Hopkins. Here, I thought that there was a genuine attempt to capture something of Tolkien's personality. You see his love of language. You also see that sort of awkward stutter that is a characteristic of his speech patterns. You see that sort of hesitation in his character, not quite shyness, but I think that somehow his nature, his essence comes across really, really well. I thought that the film also, another choice that they made that I really appreciated is their decision to narrow the focus. So many people said, well, why didn't they tell more about his life? Where are the inklings? Where is his old age? Where is his actual writing of The Lord of the Rings? I think they were really smart to not go there and to limit themselves to this early formative period of his life. I think it's far more effective that way. I thought there was something very lovely and very authentic about the friendships as well. And it's so refreshing for me to see that emphasis on that kind of playful, authentic friendship that's about something, in this case, about the power of story to change the world.
Yeah. And that's sort of what your writing has been about on The Inklings, is really the Band of Brothers approach.
Yes.
And it shows a continuity. I think that what's right about this film is there is a continuity between what you write about, which is really 1930 to 1970, and this stuff in the 19-teens. I think the continuity is there in Tolkien himself, not just in C.S. Lewis, the Kingmaker, but in the fact that Tolkien thrived upon and sought out these authentic, formative and corrective and supportive and resonating friendships. He didn't, and you can see him stumbling through it. He doesn't know what to do. At what point is a wise man called, says, Tolkien, you clown, you know, wake up, you know. or when they're on the bus, when they break into the bus, the omnibus, I guess it was, in Oxford, and get arrested. They, you know, like, it's, you know, we're your friends. You don't really understand how this works just yet.
Yes.
But you see that kind of formation in him, which would be something he misses, I think, in the last decade of his life, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when you know, when you know the biography, I think actually the film makes those points more bittersweet.
Yeah. All right. Well, how about let's have you put on the board here one or two aspects or parts that were inaccurate or you consider to be errors that they should have known better.
That's a big question. So if you're asking what's inaccurate about Tolkien, that's a different question than what's wrong with the story. And so one of the things I think is really important for people to be thinking about is how important is literal accuracy. If you're a purist and you're going to measure this according to the specific yardstick of historical accuracy, there's a lot to be disappointed in. But I don't know that that's the key question. The question is, do they get the flavor right? Do they get the images right? Do they get some of the textures right? Which I think they do really well. But I think that there are some flaws from a movie-making point of view that are worth pointing out.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what I said in my first reaction blog. I had been asked by Forefront, a sort of an arts collective, to write about the film. And so I had to seek out the film because I had made this agreement with them, and so I wanted to talk about that kind of artistic side. But I did my own reaction blog, which is just, you know what, I know that there are both, you know, problems on the timeline, and then there are the things that you just mentioned, Diana, idiosyncrasies and gaps that the film as a film could have done better. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to kind of throw myself into it and love it from that perspective. And pulling back from that, I guess to me the biggest weakness, actually I spotted it in the when we saw the previews, those early trailers. So John Garth's The Great War, Tolkien and the Great War book, talks about how in the trenches there was this weaving together of the supernatural and the folktale and the realism that was in front of them. And they try and capture that in this film by bringing the fantasy elements that will become later the Lords of the Rings and the Middle-earth Legendarium and weaving that together visually. And that was just, they just needed a lot more to do that. They just needed to be a much bigger studio. It had to be a much more complex operation to pull that off. And so they're sort of the least resonant parts of the film and the ones that kind of pop out, but in the wrong ways. So the relationship between Tolkien and his Batman, I don't remember his name, Sam something. I'm not surprised that they call him Sam. But yeah, Tolkien and his support man, he that was really important to him in the war. Yeah, Private Sam Hodges in the film. You know, that was nice. That was intimate and interesting. But the trying to make it all fit together within his kind of delirium, trench fever state, it just wasn't the strongest feature of the film.
I think that points to probably what I think is the biggest flaw, and I would have to say that the script is just horribly problematic. I think that the use of flashback and the switching from different scenes has the opposite effect of what the filmmakers had hoped for. And so I think that with a more capable script, a flashback helps to sort of ramp up the storytelling and the intensity. In this case, I think that it's handled in such a haphazard way that what happened for me as a viewer is just as soon as there was a scene that I was sort of leaning into emotionally, all of a sudden they would yank that away and I would switch to something else. I would try to lean into that and then we would switch time or switch scene or switch mood. And because of that, it was very difficult for me to stay emotionally engaged in what was a movie where individual scenes were in many ways very touching, but didn't have a forward movement and a connective tissue in terms of storytelling. So I thought the script was really weak, and some of the dialogue I thought was really weak, and that was unfortunate. However, the second time I saw the film, I was able to sit back and actually enjoy it more, especially able to enter into its more sort of imagistic nature. and not be so concerned about the way that one scene might build on another, the way that the story might be moving forward. There were some scenes that seemed odd because not much seemed to be adding to where we were going, and there wasn't the kind of setup and fulfillment that you expect in a 2-hour film.
Yeah, you even see that, like, that weakness in script. So, like, going to Mabel Tolkien's the moment where she talks about pecuniary circumstances, the sort of Charles Dickens, the Dickens kind of, you know, where what's our hero going to be? In one sense, that's great in that moment, because now we have anybody who likes literature is going to immediately invest in that. So they trust the viewer of the film to fill that one sentence with a lot of meaning, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then she says, you know, Hillary's like, well, I'm not going to get married, and so, well, it'll have to be treasure then, which is cute. But then, like, the line, well, there is treasure and there is treasure, is a really kind of weak line compared with pecuniary circumstances, right? And, you know, this is a mom preparing their kids to be without her. To see beyond their circumstances, to hope for something that exists outside of themselves, but also to be part of that hope, to be the adventurers in the hope. And so the line, there's treasure and there's treasure, isn't really, you know, that's sort of a missed opportunity after a great setup. So yeah, I agree about that even within the scenes that work, there are moments that jar a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, along those lines, then, one of the things that I wanted us to maybe consider here is that, you know, well, first of all, let me note that one of you had mentioned going into it, what people expected or was aware, like if you didn't know, this is only going to cover the young life of Tolkien. You know, there's no subtitle, which I guess, you know, I don't know if they debated that or not. They just thought, put that last name out there, people are just come running. But were there some scenes that were maybe decent enough, but maybe not covered adequately, that is an element introduced that may have been more easily missed by a viewer, like, say, on first viewing and such? Anything related to that comes to mind?
I wish they had done more with his early childhood and his loss of his parents. I thought the first 5-6 minutes especially were sort of jerky and disorienting for someone who didn't already know where he was born, what his circumstances of life were, how he lost his parents, and how Father Morgan becomes such a key figure in his life. I think that could have been done so well to sweep someone up in this early, these early difficulties, these early shortages. And I've read I don't know how many articles and biographies, and I had trouble actually figuring out, oh, yeah, that's where they are here, or, oh, that's what's happening here. The pacing seemed awkward at the very, very beginning. And so that's one place where I feel they really could have done more. I couldn't help thinking about the Disney movie Up, where they tell the entire story of this couple's entire life, and they telegraph every aspect of it so beautifully in such a compressed kind of time. I wish they'd done something more like that to get us up to the events of Tolkien's early life by taking care of this very early period. I think it's key, and I think they missed that opportunity.
Well, I think it's interesting you said that, because I actually thought the 10-minute Hobbit prelude to The Lord of the Rings would have made a nice pattern for what childhood could have been I mean, obviously not the same cuteness, but the prologues in the Jackson films are pretty good. And I think that was rushed in this case, and viewing that part of life as a prologue, I think would have been, really, really effective, because when he gets to school, that's actually pretty good when he meets the friends. And so one thing, like, so the film will, when we talk about accuracy from a purist perspective of, you know, here's the timeline of history, why does the film not match that? The film does pretty well at choosing to break certain things in order to make other things work. For example, the letter, the unmailed letter, which is used for 3 years to pace the film.
Right.
And to create tension, is a historical inaccuracy that works really well in the film. Bringing Smith in as one of the the Jeffrey, is it Bash or Baker or Smith? Anyway, G.B. Smith, bringing him in to early as the peacemaker within the Immortal Four, within the TCBS, works great. It's not accurate exactly, but it works really well. And so they know how to do that, and then they don't do that as well in the childhood scenes. They try, like, you know, as the film start off with them playing with wooden swords in the sort of an Arthurian version of Capture the Flag in the woods,
right.
I think. Right. So that one scene just captures a whole lot about who he is, right, very quickly. So it could be good, but then, yeah, we lose it. And I think it just needed maybe 2 or 3 minutes in that 6-minute segment more to make that work.
Brent, I want to say that one of the things I appreciate about the writing that you've done about the film is your willingness to say, yeah, it makes sense to do a little bit of rearranging in order to improve the story. I think that I'm a little impatient with people who demand a strict adherence to chronology or to actual events when the movie is trying to suggest or, you know, tell a larger story. I think that we have to cut them some slack, and I think that we've missed an opportunity just as fans of this author to really get behind and support something that is really good and should have been in theaters longer, should have gotten more attention, that people were so busy sort of picking the threads apart that they lost the advantage of the whole cloth that was there, that was really worth paying closer attention to and allowing themselves to enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this is, so The Imitation Game is a biopic for 3 or 4 years ago. And I think it was an award, Academy Award nominee. And so, but if you actually talk to comp sci folks, they're really kind of upset about what people do with touring, you know, touring and how they change his life and things like that. And yet I knew the story going in. It wasn't like a surprise. It was, and it laced together to me what the truth of the essential truth of the story was, and did it in quite a compelling way. And that's what I look for in a biopic. It's not what I look for in a documentary, where I want them to select out the essential story in it and still give me the framework. And then, of course, one step further would be a biography. But even in a biography, Diana, of course, and William, there's really two kind of levels. And, you know, John Garth's concentration on that decade of Tolkien and the Great War is just so much more intense and precise and well-researched, and he has 400 pages to do it. It's just not the same as what we would get. And it was, I decided to, for this podcast, reread a Tolkien, the Carpenter biography of Tolkien.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it all kind of made sense to me then. These guys have covered what John Garth was working on, but did it through Carpenter's lens. This is clearly the screenwriter's first introduction was, you know, Humphrey Carpenter's book. And when you read the biography next to the film, it actually makes a lot of sense, the choices that are made and the kind of sweep that Carpenter has to do. I mean, he covers the whole war in about, you know, 20 pages or something.
Yeah.
Right. And Diane, I think your work is really a response to Carpenter in a lot of ways, but when it comes to looking for the compelling storyline within the history, he's pretty good at that.
Oh yeah. He's very, very good. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what these guys have done. And when it's done well, I think I'll give them the space to do that.
Well, I definitely want to come back to the books you've been mentioning here, but before we do that, something that you were mentioning, Diana, in terms of the film and it being out in theaters, one of the things I know we also wanted to cover, because Brent and we were talking about this also before we started recording, is the, you know, it not being in a lot of theaters, and then I wonder if some initial reviews made some people not go out when it first came out. For those who aren't too familiar, if the official U.S. release was May the 10th, I believe the week before it was out in the U.K., so we're recording now here less than 4 weeks later, and I didn't look to see how many theaters it was going to be in this present weekend, but I'm almost certain it's probably fewer, because it's definitely wasn't in the top 10 in the U.S. numbers that I saw last weekend. But what is the challenge to, you know, in terms of getting in theaters, or just how hard is it for people who don't appreciate the fact that, you know, a movie coming to your local theater is not such an easy thing, even for a well-known author like J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think my experience of going to it is different than Diana's. I'll let her tell hers in a second. But so mine, I live on one end of the continent that the three of us occupy, and I'm at the far northeast, and it wasn't even in my province. I had to go to a different province and travel to see the film in a theater, and simply because there's just not the energy. And these films, we don't have a space for them yet. If it had been produced by Netflix or Amazon, then there's a built-in audience. There is no release, or they'll start doing releases, but it's largely a living room release, right? And the numbers are hard to kind of track there. But it's also not a Cannes Film Festival film. It's not an art piece in that kind of a way. And really what probably this film needed to do was really launch actually out of Toronto Film International Film Festival, which falls between those. But it's hard for films that aren't indie films but are still low budget to really find a space. And if it hadn't been picked up by Fox Searchlight, which does edgy, unusual films, almost none of us would have been able to see it. It would have been in 200 or 300 houses across North America and England. So I appreciate that they gave us a try on this one, and I hope that there was enough energy that we get a great DVD release out of it in the fall.
Yeah, Diana, you live in a somewhat larger city. People may or may not have heard of it. What would that be?
Yeah, I'm in Los Angeles, and so my experience is going to be quite a bit different from Brenton. So I had the opportunity to go to the Hollywood premiere with the actors and the director and some of the Fox Searchlight folks. And then less than a week later, there was a theater, 15 minutes away from my home, that was showing it as well to very healthy-sized crowds. So my access to it was quite different. But there's something that worries me a bit. There was such negative reviews of this, and so much sort of from the Tolkien fan side, there was so much sort of picking at it. And from the sort of larger set of reviews, people were pretty negative about it. And I worry about that because I'm afraid that the filmmakers might be paying attention and might be saying to themselves, it's not worth taking a risk on a film like this. What people are demanding are things that are these big budget, you know, Avengers-style kinds of movies, and otherwise, then it's not worth doing this kind of storytelling. And I think that is a terrible message for us to be sending. I wish that we had done a better job just as viewers of saying, this is the kind of film that's actually very worthwhile, that we appreciate and that we want to see more of. And I don't know that that's the message that we send.
Yeah. Yeah, that's too bad. And they are, of course, the filmmakers are watching. I mean, we live in a watched age. And it's just, so my sort of fanboy blog, you know, was read by the director and retweeted out, right? So they're watching our response, and I don't know what to do about that, Diana, exactly. You know, and are we speaking as academics, are we speaking as fans, or are we speaking as public intellectuals when we answer the question about how do we react to these things? But the reality is, I would love an average biopic on about 20 different people that I would love to hear more about from history. And even if I disagreed with their interpretation, at least I have something to press my feet against to launch off on. You know, for me, it's all gain. So I don't know. I guess I would like a little more openness from readers and from critics.
Sure. I totally agree with that. I mean, as a Tolkien scholar, what I do, you know, I can talk about a list of 30 things that I wish they had done differently.
Yeah.
But what I want to say to the filmmakers is thank you. Yes, thank you for investing so much, because it was clear to me, and in listening to the actors talk about their experience on set and in listening to the director, it was clear that they really believed in this and they really were trying to make a good film and they really cared about it. And I want to say thank you. We, as a film goer, as someone, you know, as a consumer of media, I was really grateful to see a film like this, whether you're a Tolkien fan or not. I wish we had more of this kind of thing. I'm deeply grateful, and I wish that message had gotten out a little bit more loudly and clearly.
Of course, I chose to go to this instead of Pikachu or whatever that film was. That was Pikachu's Revenge. Or I can't remember what the film was out there. Although I did go to the
Endgame.
Yeah, Endgame. I did go to Endgame a couple of times. And so this is and it could be that in 5 years we don't even have the option for this kind of thing if the film isn't being made by one of our big streaming companies. I wonder if a $20 million film or a $10 million film is just simply not going to exist. And I suspect, like, this cast is all, these are all up-and-coming folk rather than, although Nicholas Holt is fairly well-established, you know, and Lily Collins, too. I mean, this was a pretty compelling cast for a film of this stature. And Collins and Holt did these videos where they would just send out these "I hope you like our film" kind of messages, and I kind of liked the folksiness of that. I don't want us to sacrifice, you know, say, you know, when it's time to say, okay, we're going to actually talk about some of the artistic merits or some of the biographical merits. Yeah, that, you know, good criticism is good criticism, but the kind of super, you know, super wipe everything off the. You know, just get rid of everything because it doesn't match my ideas of this or that is I don't think helpful, and it will mean we won't get, you know, a future biography of anybody at any stature, right? Unless it's you know it's got, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch starring or something, right?
That may draw a few people. Now, speaking of I'm going to change to a topic of DVD release. I want to be sure we talk about that before we wrap up, and that is, if I heard correctly, the DVD release, which we don't know necessarily, I'm sure it'll be a couple months from when we're recording probably, but there are those who went to an early viewing in the U.S. There was a live simulcast with some questions that were pitched, I believe, to the director, and it was noted that there would be some deleted scenes on the DVD that especially dealt with his faith. So I guess the question then will be, what have you heard? And then, not knowing necessarily what was filmed, what would you like would have been or could be on this DVD release?
I've heard there's a scene of him in church, and that's one of the deleted scenes that people have been talking about. I don't agree with a lot of the critics who said that they thought that his faith had been sort of scrubbed out of the movie. I felt like it was there in the same way that faith issues are there in The Lord of the Rings. It was not pointed to in a specific and concrete way, but it seemed to me to be overarching so many scenes and so many aspects of the film that I didn't see that as something that was suppressed in a particular way. It seemed to me to be just part of the whole.
Well, let's talk about, I think the film release is early September, September 9th or 10th or something. And I hope for a great kind of, you know, at least an extra 15 minutes in the film. And I hope the score works really well with that, because it's worked well so far. I would love to see a couple more of those faith things. I'll push back a little bit, Diana, on that, and simply this. And then I want to push back on myself after I say this. So if we ask let's imagine this is let's call this a film about Tolkien's early loves, the things he loves, right? And if we say language, I think we see that in the film, right? Yep. If we say art, I think we see that in the film. If we say Edith, I think I'm certain we see that in the film. At least captivation, right? And if we see friendship, that's in the film. And myth, it's on its way in the film, Right? I would love to have seen that just a little deeper. But I think they're trying to use language and the art, especially the visual art. It's a film to capture the myth, right? So,
the Wagner scene. Yeah,
the Wagner scene, which was kind of a nice scene. So, if you read John Garth's book, the religious element of all that is woven in so deeply and so early, as he seems to be trying to work out that faith element in himself, his religious element in himself, and with the feeling, if Carpenter's right, that his mother died because the family didn't take care of her.
Right,
which was a faith-divided moment, right? Mabel Tokine cuts herself off because she becomes Roman Catholic. And so I think on its own standards, I would have loved to see more faith, because this is a film about the loves of Tokine, even if it's a bit ambivalent. Although I hope no one disagrees with me that Cole Meany as Father Francis did a beautiful job, and I thought all that was done well. And I think on its own merits, I think the struggle with religion could be a little stronger on the film's own merits, as the film that it is, and not as something else, right? Not as a strict biography or timeline or a religious film. But my pushback on that is my article for Forefront, which was, well, what model would these European filmmakers have had for what authentic faith struggle looks like for serious Catholics or serious Christians? And I have to say, I don't know what the model would be, to be honest. You know, it's not a Billy Graham evangelistic film. It's not the Sony Entertainment Mom's Night Out or whatever Christian films, where a football player wins and so Jesus is awesome. You know, what's the model, right? And I don't know that we have in film today a sophisticated model of either, you know, Christian or Jewish filmmakers saying this is what we're really struggling with, if it's not deconstructive. And so I don't know what to say. I'm glad that they did that, but rather than leave him faithless, and or awkward, or ritualistic for no meaning on the screen. So my pushback is, even on its own standards, I think it could have been a little bit deeper. But I'm glad they didn't do it poorly, is what I mean. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I think there is. The one scene where they attempt it, I think it's kind of clumsy, and that's in one of the battle scenes, right, where you have the horrors of war and then the flash of the crucifix as if the crucifix looming large and close, right, is the thing that ultimately is the antidote or the protection, the way that that's that particular instant is even presented, is the antidote to all of this ugliness, right? Mm. Sort of the cross in that scene, if you remember, sort of stands in between you as the viewer and the war scenes that are going on in the background. And yeah. I think that that's their attempt to say this looms large by having a crucifix that literally looms in the way that it does on the screen. So I think that they're trying. I really do. And to me, that's one moment where there's at least that attempt to show it. And I think there's something else, and that's that you mentioned the portrayal of Father Francis. One of my biggest fears going in is that he would be portrayed as a fool or as inherently evil, or that his decision to forbid Tolkien and Edith to meet together would be viewed as some tremendous, flash of anger, evil kind of thing. Those were all done well, and his character came across as genuinely faithful, a person of genuine faith and a genuine concern. And if not a noble character, at least an admirable one. And I remember one of my very first thoughts leaving the theater was, it's rare to see a priest portrayed in a generally positive light. And I was really grateful for that.
Yeah, it's too rare. I was so relieved by the Well, I was relieved by the choice, just because Colmeny has been a strong, you know, he's been the one of the, you know, top 20 supporting actors the last 40 years. So he just consistently does that sort of role. Yeah. Well, and both the mentors were pretty strong. Derek Jacobi as Professor Wright was pretty cool.
Yeah, he was.
And the language stuff. But then that moment where war, everybody's celebrating war on the lawn. And again, this is one of those moments where they trusted the viewer to bring their stories in and invest them into the moment. And Tolkien's reading, his translation, I can't remember if it's Gawain or what it was. I should have written this down. And he mentions his language and the rhythm, which is, of course, Tolkien's real strength in poetry, was the alliterative verse. And then, you know, Wright had been, you know, but he didn't come from this culture, and he basically was a self-taught linguist and then went and studied in Germany, and now they were at war against Germany and are studying Germanic languages. And Tolkien, who's got all this potential, is about to go off and could die. Like, all of that moment is just sitting there, and I thought that was really well done. So I thought the two mentors as mentors were very strong in that way. The moment in the hospital when... the kind of nice moment when Father Francis is talking about what do you say to these people whose boys have gone off and died. And he just says, all they can really say is dot, dot, dot. And that was the moment to really kind of say what's the most substantial Catholic response to the war. And that there was a moment for something weighty and amazing there. And it didn't happen. It was
They pulled back instead.
Yeah, they pulled back. It was like time will heal all wounds kind of a response instead of, you know, Christ is there in our suffering or something like that, right? Which they did visually.
Well, now our time's going to get away in terms of what we spoke about in terms of having for the program here. And then, I guess one of the things related to that is the fact that most people listening to this podcast are at least very familiar with Lewis, as well as Tolkien. And then there will be those who never heard of this program, All About Jack, until they noticed there was a talk about the movie here. So in a second, I want to maybe close, or one of the closing questions will be, what books do you recommend for those who want to read more about his life and work? But since I sent you some questions in advance in terms of topics, before we get to the question of what books would you recommend, is there anything that we hadn't already, in terms of some of the things that I pitched as possible topics that you had some thoughts? We'll do a final, you know, have some final thoughts about the movie, but anything new that we haven't yet touched on for either of you?
Well, I hope people are drawn into language and story and art as a. I think that was a draw in the film, and I hope people are drawn in. And then I would hope that if people are anxious about the faith elements or the biographical elements, I would hope that they would do one of these two things well, depending on their own gifts. I would hope, one, they either become great biographers and historians and do that super well, or they become great artists and they learn to tell stories of faith compellingly. And so that would be my response. It's a kind of a hard pushback against people who have resisted aspects of the film. And my answer is really go and do it well yourself. And I will be open to seeing what you do.
And I would just say that I think that Tolkien's life in and of itself is a terrific story. And I hope that this little glimpse of some of the key elements of his life will motivate people to want to learn more. I think that the role of the TCBS, the Tea Club, and Barovian Society, these young men who were such an important part of what you think of as the cradle of Tolkien's imagination, they're such an important group, and there isn't enough discussion of them, recognition of their role, and so on. I'm obviously a scholar who is very interested in the role of the Inklings, but I don't want to let the Inklings and that experience completely eclipse the importance of the TCBS, because I just think that that deserves a lot more attention. Tolkien, of course, was a member of lots of groups, and he was the founder of most of the groups that he became a key part of. that's an important thing to know about his imagination and his whole, all of his creative work. One of the reviews that I read by the musician Andrew Peterson said that he wished that the film had shown the extent to which the Inklings go on to really fulfill the dream that was sparked in the Tea Club and Barovian society. And that's a wonderful thing. And so in that sense, the story of the Inklings really isn't complete until you see the way in which this earlier group had such a big impact. And I think that that's really worth emphasizing and worth noticing. Another aspect of that, I think, too, again, a little bit more in an area that's of particular interest to me, is the courage that it took Tolkien to invest in the Inklings the way that he did, having invested so deeply in the TCBS and seeing the devastation as that group came to an end. And yet he rallies, he picks himself up and dusts himself off and finds other poets and writers and creative folk to connect with. And I think there's a great lesson there.
Yeah, those are great points. Of course, Andrew Peterson always just says great things.
He always does.
And he's one of those artists that understands the mythic kind of depth of the element that we're looking for here. And so, which is, I think, why he's reading the Inklings, right? So is for that. I'd also say, can I suggest, you know, there were four of the TCBS. So these were four lads that really had great giftings in and of themselves. And they went off to war. And in that war, two of them died and never really got to share. Will Smith had a book of poetry come out later. They didn't get to share those gifts, those two. And really, one of them faltered after the war and may not have reached the potential that he could have reached. And I guess I would suggest that we, as people, try not to start gigantic wars that kill the hope of a generation. it's sort of a weird thing to say in a podcast, but I think that actually happens in the way that we relate to one another in a much more specific way than we sometimes imagine, that wars actually come out of culture, not just happen to culture. So that's a weird thing to say, I understand, but that's what I want to say.
Well, then let's go ahead and what books you all have mentioned some books, but for those who are especially maybe new just to Tolkien and only know about him through even just the movies like The Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit, what books about Tolkien would you recommend for those who want to read more about his life and work?
Well, your listeners are going to be very familiar with C.S. Lewis and the fact that we are still waiting to have the official, comprehensive, really, really, really good biography of C.S. Lewis. It hasn't been written yet. There are good ones, but most of them are problematic in some pretty major ways. Unlike the field of Lewis studies, the field of Tolkien studies has had a good, solid biography, and that's Humphrey Carpenter's biography of Tolkien, and it's really quite good. Carpenter's a great writer. And he's brisk, he's journalistic, he's interesting, he has a wonderful ear for the language and a wonderful eye for the telling detail. And it's not, I don't know that a perfect biography exists of anybody in any genre, but this is a really, really good biography, and I like it a lot. People who want a fuller picture than that, I would say go to Tolkien's letters. We're very fortunate that we have a book of his letters and listen to Tolkien himself talk about these events and talk about kind of his own experiences and his own voice.
Yeah. And actually, and to be fair, Carpenter also edited those letters.
Yes, he did.
With some help. Yeah, that's right. And if you pick up Carpenter's biography, the pictures in it, you'll find actually that the Mabel, I mean, Lily Collins is obviously gorgeous in an unusual human capacity, but she's actually a pretty good representation of Edith Tolkien. And so is Professor Wright, pretty stunningly captured by Derek Jacobi, even just as a face. So there's kind of fun stuff there. John Garth's The Tolkien and the Great War, The Threshold of Middle-Earth, is sort of the gold standard on a super specific... Now, this is more of a historical piece rather than a biographical piece, if I can make that distinction. And what he does for us, which is kind of fun, is really two things that he gave me as a reader that I didn't get from other places. One, he went into the records of the schools that Tolkien went to up until Oxford, and including Oxford, and that was... new stuff I wouldn't have access to just by searching online. And then he loops in the poetry really well, the early poetry and some of the later poetry really well into that narrative. So I think that's important. And I think that's as close as we get to a TCBS study of any depth. And really the film, rereading this Garth book, the film allowed me to kind of find the Garth book actually more moving, actually, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And so it gave me images that Garth, with all his precision, wasn't, you know, it filled it out for me. And of course, you know, listeners should of course pick up Diane and Glyer's books.
Yes.
And so what I'll do is I'll just briefly say that, so there's two. There's Bandersnatch, which William referenced right at the top of the hour, which is the popular level book that tells the story of how the Inklings, in particular, Lewis and Tolkien, work together and create, you know, these books that have transformed the world. They really have. And of course, she brings in the half dozen or so other writers that were involved at the time. That book, Bandersnatch, is great for artists and writers and people like that looking at collaboration and trying to work out their own materials in this age when you can write something amazing and no one knows, right? We don't have access to the publishers, and there's such a, you know, thousands of people trying to get their stuff out in the world. That's a great book for that. For those that want to dig a bit deeper, the book, the company they keep, which would be, I think, at least a dozen years old now, Diana, is it? Is really kind of the super nerd book version. It's one that you read it with a pencil and in hand. Although it's also one that I reread for this film. As a background to the film, I read a bunch of books, and I didn't have time, and so I actually bought the audiobook version. And the audiobook version is pretty good, Diana. I mean, I had to stop and look at the paper copy just because I didn't believe the reader at a couple points, because there's some pretty interesting links that you would never, you think of Tolkien as pretty independent, and then you read what Diana says. And so I had to stop and go and look it up to make sure that the reader was reading it correctly. But yeah, it was, so that was a great way to reread it. So that makes it even more accessible, I think.
And I want to add that there are podcast interviews I did with Diana on each of those. We encourage people to go out and just get the books themselves. But if they want some more background information about it, they can listen to the podcast. And that the original one, the company that they keep. Let's see, Diana, you woke up one day, had the idea for the book, and you had it finished in a couple months, correct?
Oh, if only it were like that. No, the company they keep took me 23 years to write. It's it's the book of my heart. It's a labor of love. I was teaching that in a class with a group of students at Azusa Pacific University, and I had a student come up to me after class and say, "Professor Glyer, you wrote The Company They Keep as if you care about every single detail of the Inkling's life." And I said, "Yes, ma'am, I do."
Yeah.
Shook her head and she said, "Not everybody does." And that's why I wrote Bandersnatch.
That's right.
People who kind of want the highlight reel of the interaction of the Inklings. Thank you for the kind words about that. If I can make one more recommendation of a book I think that people should read, I think a lot of people think that Tolkien is best represented by the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings films. And I think the films are great in a lot of ways and have a lot to recommend them, but they're not the same as Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. So Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings is great. But Tolkien's Lord of the Rings is astonishing. I had the opportunity to teach a graduate class this last semester just on The Lord of the Rings, to do a nice slow read through the whole thing with a whole class of grad students. And this is a book you just can't get to the bottom of. And, you know, we talk about Tolkien's love of language, but you start reading passages of this out loud and you start looking at the way this man crafts a story. It is a masterpiece. It is simply a masterpiece. And so if there are any listeners who've just never gotten around to picking up an actual copy of the book and working through Lord of the Rings itself, I just really encourage you to do that.
Yeah, that's actually great. And there's actually, in the Blogosphere podcast, there's all kinds of great resources too. So if you have been a secret lover of Tolkien and you want to go deeper, there's a lot of great digital connections now. I work with Signum University. Mythgard Academy has free, like, you know, master's level, like, long classes that go through these books kind of bit by bit, and so there's just great resources. And so reach out to one of us or look online and make that connection, because you know, there's a lot of love there. And we've talked about kind of some of the purest responses, and actually what has amazed me is how many people have said what I said, which is, you know, actually I really I like aspects of this film. And so in my circles, I found that people have been much more generative and positive and hopeful about things like this rather than just critical. So there's stuff there for you.
Well, now, one other resource, there's a book version out, but if I understand, there's also a documentary coming soon. Again, we're recording this in June 1st of 2019, but the book, Hobbit, A Wardrobe and a Great War, is a book that's been out for several years. And do either of you know the status of the documentary type that's coming out?
Yeah, that's, yeah. Are you in that, Diana?
I am. I've been working with the filmmakers a little bit. And so they have a rough cut of the first film in the series. It's going to be a series of films. Okay. And it looks really good. They're lavishing a lot of attention and care in getting it right. It is a documentary, and so they're working real hard on the facts and so forth. That they hope will be ready to start shopping this fall.
Yeah, yeah. And I teach with Joe LeCon at the King's College, and so, yeah. And I don't know. It's a great kind of popular level read. And I would encourage people, if you love that sort of thing. I think actually this is one of the cases on the mock-ups that I've seen and the bits that I've seen of the film thus far. This is one of the cases where actually the documentary could do as well or better than the book, even at drawing people into the story.
I think it'll do a lot in terms of that. I think that they've been really careful to bring in scholars. When LeConte worked on that book, he was much stronger on aspects of the history than he was on Lewis or Tolkien.
Yeah. And yeah, he's a historian.
Really, he's really gotten up to speed. And I think that in some way, I think it might be fair to say that the film version will be a little bit of a corrective to that very, very popular book. And I'm excited about that dimension of it.
Yeah, and I actually even saw that. I remember he got big press releases when that book came out. You could see him almost immediately rethinking that. But that's actually how he teaches with his students at the King's College. He's just very generous and open-doored, and he really talks with people about things. And he is a historian, right, rather than a biographer. And right. I think that's where the strengths were. The book was also trying to be a cultural criticism of sorts, and I think that needed a bit more work for the American context. There was just a little more needed to be said about what he was sort of tackling. And a lot has changed between 2014 and 2019, even though that's pretty recent, culturally speaking, in America.
All right. Well, then let's go ahead and any final comments. You guys offered some a little bit ago before we talked about the books. But in terms of the movie, I think if listeners paid attention to what's been said, that, you know, give this biopic a chance. If it's still out there, if you're listening to this podcast soon after it's been released, you may still be able to catch it in theaters. If not, sometime later in 2019, it'll be available for DVD release. Closing thoughts before we say our goodbyes.
I don't know. I just enjoyed talking about this. I was really impressed with how people responded to my response to the film. I had none of, like, when I once said online that I didn't think Peter Jackson, who did the Hobbit films, I didn't think it was the end of the world, that I thought there were interesting things in there. I was called, like, really bad things for that. You know, like, I was called a non-moral human being because I thought, because I enjoyed aspects of the Hobbit films. And I didn't get any of that this time. And what I'm hoping is for a grander response of people. And I would like us to bigify our watching and reading of things, and do kind of what C.S. Lewis talks about in The Experiment of in criticism, where we throw ourselves in and receive what's there, and then we judge actually what's there rather than what we wish was there. And so that's what I would like to say. And also watch, I think, Anthony Boyle, who is G.B. Smith in the film, and I think he just had this compelling, beautiful face, and I think he's going to be a great actor in years to come. But that one's for free, that bit.
I think my final comment might be to say there are a couple of things I wish I'd known the first time that I saw the film. I enjoyed the film a lot better the second time because I was aware, first of all, that they do play with flashback a lot. Mm-hmm. And that, for me, the first time was more distracting than helpful. And the second time, because I was expecting it, I kind of let it do its thing and wasn't as distracted by that. And that was very helpful for me. So that would be the main thing, is that to understand that they're playing with the idea of a fever or a fever dream in the war sequences. They're playing with timeline in the sense that they're using they're doing storytelling through skipping around a bit. And if you kind of let them do that and recognize that it's not going to be straightforward storytelling, I think that it's a lot easier to do, as you suggest, Brenton, to just let the film be what it is, to enjoy it. I almost think you can enjoy it as like it's a slideshow almost, where individual scenes are kind of jewels in themselves, but they're mixed up in a little bit of what I think is a bit of a random or distracting way, but each one is still worth enjoying for what it brings, and I think it's very valuable in that way.
Great. Well, thank you for closing thoughts there, and I hope the listeners, if they haven't had an opportunity to check out the movie for themselves, will do that. And I just as a closing thought here, I did get a chance to see the movie, but I did have to. It wasn't just a 15-minute walk or drive from my house because it's it wasn't easy available. But I did enjoy it for what it was. I don't know about talking as much as I do about Lewis, but I knew enough to where I could, you know, kind of catch things that were maybe, yeah, that's not the most accurate. But I did try to receive the film, as you were just noting, Brenton, for what it was. And I hope listeners will receive this podcast for what it is, talking about a film and giving some thoughts. And thanks, everyone, for listening. And thank you, Diana and Brenton, for joining me on All About Jack.
Thanks, William.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks.
Again, let me thank you, the listener, for joining me and my guest for this discussion of the Tolkien biopic that came out in May 2019. After my chat with Diana and Brenton, I checked online and a source I saw estimated the DVD will be out sometime in August 2019. So if you are hearing this show after that date, then you should be able to purchase or rent a copy. There's a chance I might actually do another podcast on the movie to discuss it in light of the DVD extras, so be sure to check my site to see. During the show, there were a variety of articles mentioned and a few books. You can check the show notes for direct links to them, as well as to links to other interviews I've done with my guests today. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show, but it also could be easier to locate the notes where the audio files are hosted at allaboutjack.podbean.com. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. At either location, you can find various podcasts, which typically feature interviews to authors of books about Lewis, but I've also done an occasional series about a specific Lewis essay, as well as a special series on Why Read Lewis, among other shows. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes. If you don't know how to do that, then check the show notes for a direct link and consider rating my show there, as well as sharing this podcast with others. Before ending, let me also remind you again about the two books I've published. The most recent is called The Misquotable C.S. Lewis. It explores 75 questionable quotations and talks about why you shouldn't share Lewis quotes unless you know he really said them. I also reveal the closest things Lewis said related to the questionable saying, which I examine, and relate the fun I had tracking the quotes down. I have also written an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters that is called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. You can learn more about that book by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get an immediate download of a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Purchasing either of my books is a great way to indirectly support this podcast and to make sure it remains freely available. Also, there is a link in the show notes where you can find the latest sales on Lewis books, as well as his books in general and books related to him. Purchasing through this link also helps support me. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.